Anya found no useful documents at the university library. However, a helpful student aide suggested she check with the city library. Arriving there, she met Mr. Vigory, the special collections librarian, as he stalked along between shelves stuffed with age-blackened books. He was a middle-aged, middle-height man with a balding head and a frizzy fringe of white hair that came down in sideburns and met over his upper lip in a mustache that made him resemble a walrus. His protuberant eyes were light brown, moist, and gentle behind round-lensed spectacles.
Promessa? So, you're interested in our famous lost civilization?
You've heard of it?
It was a popular legend among slaves from about the 18th century onward, especially those laboring on the rubber plantations before the abolition of slavery. Even afterward, I dare say. Even after emancipation, working conditions weren't always ideal, nor are they today, for that matter, especially farther up the river.
You're saying Promessa is a legend, then?
Ah, but that doesn't mean the stories aren't true, or don't contain a germ of truth. Perhaps... Aha, this is the volume I am looking for.
Mr. Vigory opened the volume on the table. A gloved finger slid above the yellowed, mottled paper, tracing crabbed lines of handwriting in ink that had faded to purple and stained out into the paper, blurring each word slightly. This, too, was familiar to Anya, who was actually accustomed to tomes much older and in even worse shape. This book, she judged by its condition and appearance, was not much more than a century old.
Here we've an account written by a superintendent at a rubber plantation farther up the river in 1905. You can read it, yes?
Yes. Lobo tells me that three more workers ran away from the Northfield barracks last night.
Lobo was an overseer on the plantation. Well named. A beast of a man. In his spare time, he used to shoot Indians for sport.
Seriously?
All too much so.
He tells me they are talking again of this damn Quilombo of dreams, where a man can be free
and live forever. I sent him out armed with good Mausers and with dogs, but the rascals had got clean away. Even Lobo will only go so far. Parties who hunt escaped laborers tend to vanish as if the cursed selva swallows them alive. The workers say the Maroons still look out for their own.
So, what have we here? We don't get many Norte Americanas in here.
This is Anya Creed. She is an important archaeologist. Anya, this is Guilhermu, my aide.
Nice to meet you, Guilhermu.
So you're an archaeologist hunting for the Fountain of Youth?
What do you mean?
You're reading up on Promessa, aren't you? The mythical city of dreams?
The Quilombo of dreams, yes. I'm fascinated by the Quilombo phenomenon, as well as the possibility fugitive ex-slaves from the coast over 1,400 kilometers away might have penetrated this far and farther up the Amazon basin.
But the City of the Promise is all about wonders, walking through walls, shapeshifters, living forever. Now, I don't blame you for looking, Miss Creed. Who wouldn't want to live forever and keep their beauty? I know I do.
Well, what about the dangers the superintendent writes about? This Lobo doesn't sound like the sort of man who'd be easily scared off by mere superstitious rumors.
Oh, the threat was real enough, and still is today. It's just the Indians, miserable savages, with no regard for human life at all.
The aide's words struck Anya like a slap. She definitely wasn't in Kansas anymore. No matter how much time she spent abroad, trying to keep her mind open to other beliefs and ways, as an archaeologist should, things still managed to shock her. She thought she caught a hint of sadness in Vigory's old hound dog eyes.
What about that report from a few months ago, in the spring, about a whole company of loggers with bulldozers and soldiers who disappeared in the space of an afternoon, farther up the Amazon?
The Indians are clever devils. They know their land. There was an ambush. Nothing supernatural about it.
Surely men with enormous machines and modern weapons don't just vanish.
And yet, they did. More than 100, many of them foreign mercenaries. A certain prominent state official vanished with them. It was the talk of all the cafes for weeks.
Huh.
Lady, that kind of thing doesn't even make it to the internet. You'll never see it on TV or read it in the papers. But it goes on all the time.
It was darker on this stretch of the Manaus riverfront than Anya had anticipated. The River of Dreams Trading Company warehouse office complex lay a few miles up the Rio Negros from the Deepwater Port facility. The port was a blaze of light, the big freighters and container ships hives of activity at all hours. Looking toward them, it was hard to imagine they were almost 1,000 miles from the sea. Dan had led her into a space between the River of Dreams building and a neighboring structure that looked abandoned. They wore dark clothing, jeans, and long-sleeved shirts, despite the hammering tropical heat. Both had rolled down their sleeves as they entered the alleyway to reduce the reflection from their white skin. Given the desperate poverty and rampant crime in much of Brazil, Anya was surprised the import-export company didn't take more overt security measures. Chain-link fencing, cameras, and floodlights would seem the least precautions a waterfront business might take, yet there was none of that. Just a battered, green-painted metal door in a yellow fan of light from an external fixture with a conical shade. Anya looked around, but saw no sign of activity in the immediate area. The humidity was so heavy, Anya almost felt as if she were swimming through the air as she followed Dan to the metal door. The air stunk of petrochemicals and water and decaying vegetation.
Remember, Anya, what we're about to do is for the greater good.
You can get through this door?
You never know what skills will come in handy for an anti-corporate activist.
Anya kept her head swiveling up and down the alley. She also forced herself to remember to look up periodically. She'd sneaked up on people before by exploiting the human tendency to look only horizontally.
There. After you, m'lady.
With tight lips and compressed brow, Anya moved past him. She stuck her head around the frame in a 3-second look. Then she slipped inside. The warehouse was a cavern whose gloom seemed more accentuated than diminished by widely spaced yellow lights shining from the high ceiling. Anya stepped reflexively to the left of the door. Dan slipped in behind her, moving a few steps to the right.
You've been acting all innocent, where clearly you've done this kind of thing before.
Just clearing the fatal funnel. I do know anybody lingering in an open doorway makes an ideal target.
Yeah, I'll look for an office. Why don't you scout around?
So why not just break into the front office if that's what you were looking for?
They had better security on the pretty glossy stuff out front.
Anya shrugged in vague concurrence. They went by separate paths. It was hot and close in the warehouse, almost stifling. Metal catwalks ran around the edge of the warehouse, which was built of grayish brick. Others crossed overhead. To what purpose, Anya couldn't tell. Wooden crates rose in tall stacks in some parts of the warehouse. In others, high metal shelves held boxes of various sizes. It all looked pretty straightforward. She began a circuit of the perimeter. She was mostly interested in getting her bearings. She wasn't really sure what Dan, or Publico, expected to achieve. Doors opened into little side chambers off the main room. Workshops, smaller storage areas where she guessed office supplies were kept, as opposed to stock awaiting shipment up or down the Great River complex. Anya looked over to Dan, who nodded with satisfaction as a door into a windowed office area gave way before his efforts. He stepped inside. She saw no sign of any kind of security measures, no obvious cameras or motion detectors, but she knew that with modern technology, a camera could be invisibly small. Still, the whole feel of the place suggested a bygone era. Not the high, wide, long-gone days of the rubber boom, but sometime before omnipresent surveillance and spy bugs. The 50s, perhaps. Sometime before she'd lived, when things were simpler. It was hard to focus without knowing what she was supposed to be focusing on. She wondered if her employer and partner were having a fit of male chauvinism, not trusting a mere woman with the real story. But why bring her in at all if that were the case? She found some wood crates with some paperwork attached. She studied the bills of lading. The crates, it appeared, contained medical supplies, equipment, and drugs, consigned for some place called Feliz Lusitania. They came mostly through Belém, originating primarily from South America and Europe. There seemed to be a lot of them. She wondered what Feliz Lusitania might be. The literal translation was Happy Portugal. Instinctively, Anya spun. A dark figure flew at her, down from a 10-foot stack of crates at her back. She raised her hands and grabbed out. Using her attacker's own weight against her, she guided the person jumping at her past and into the stack of crates bound for Feliz Lusitania. Blue and white cardboard cartons spilled around as the person came to rest. The attacker was a small black woman with dreadlocks, wearing a loose blouse, ragged shorts, and sandals. She looked unconscious, or at the very least stunned. Backing away down the aisle between stacks of crates so that the woman couldn't instantly spring on her again once she recovered, Anya looked around. Two men approached from different directions, hemming her in. One was taller than her, rangy, and looked Latino but had long dreadlocks shadowing his face. The other, she saw, turning her head swiftly left and right and then back, was blonde and sturdy, a bit shorter than her. Both were dressed in rough workman-style clothing. The blonde man rushed her from behind. It was what she had expected, standard tactical sandwich. The solid rubber heel of her walking shoes slammed his sternum like the kick of a horse. Anya turned her attention to her taller attacker. He swung a roundhouse blow toward her face. She moved to block, but he dropped lithely to one arm and swept her legs out from under her with one smooth motion. Anya had managed to get an arm down to act as a shock absorber, but still took the brunt of the landing on her left butt cheek. The pain shot up the side of her body, and she knew she'd have a fabulous bruise. She also knew she'd be lucky if she got out of this warehouse suffering no worse. She arched her back, pressed the backs of her shoulders into the concrete, and jackknifed forward and upward. The motion snapped her back upright to her feet. The dreadlocked man swung his right leg for her head, and with no time to reverse her forward momentum, she stepped forward with her forearms vertical. She used a powerful downward stroke of the bottom of her forearm at the juncture of his long legs. A set of powerful legs were suddenly locked around Anya's waist. Already turning clockwise, she drove her legs to slam her assailant into the stack of crates at her right. Feeling the weight and size of the attacker latch to her back, Anya gathered that her initial assailant had quickly recovered from getting thrown through a crate and had gone straight back on the attack. The Promesans were tough, she had to admit. The woman's python-like arms sought to encircle her throat, but Anya managed to block the choke by tucking her chin into the crook of her attacker's right arm. She slammed her head back. The female attacker's whole body slackened. Anya's right hand tangled in her long hair, and Anya snapped the limp body forward. She held tight onto the woman's scalp, preventing the assailant's skull from cracking on the concrete. Anya figured that at least one more of her previous attackers would recover fast and be right back on her. She was right. The dreadlocked man was indeed back on his feet, approaching her in a sort of forward-leaning crouch. He did what she recognized as the standard capoeira dance, stepping forward and back with wide swings of arms and hips. It was clearly intended to distract or even hypnotize an opponent while keeping the capoeirista's body in motion. Her counter was to stand with weight on her back foot and arms raised, hands relaxed, not clenched into fists. She'd already had success letting him attack first, however inadvertently, and counterattacking. Now she'd count on letting him commit, then using her cat-like reflexes to parry or evade before slamming him. Because of his constant smiling motion, side to side, back and forth, she forced her eyes to stay in soft focus, rather than focusing directly on her foe. It saved her life. High and to her left, motion caught the very corner of her peripheral vision. It was the distinctive movement of an arm raising a weapon to fire. Anya threw herself flat on her back, legs drawn up, ready to kick with powerful leverage if her opponent leaped for her. A green spear of light cracked through the space Anya had occupied a heartbeat before. A feather of greenish smoke wisped upward from the crates the shot hit, and Anya's nostrils filled with the smell of charred wood. She saw no flame. Her opponent seemed more disoriented by the blast than she was. Guessing he was seeing nothing but big magenta shards of afterimage, she launched herself into a forward roll, body tucked in a tight ball to keep low out of the laser's field of fire. As she rolled over the top, she whipped out her right leg into an axe kick towards the face of the dreadlocked man. A shadow suddenly fell across Anya, and some instinct made her roll to her right. Concrete exploded, stinging her calf through the jeans she wore. Now, Anya's own eyes dazzled with pink afterimage lines, but she knew her assailant was standing right over her. In another second, he or she would lean forward, correct aim, and blast her apart with the energy gun. Anya jumped to her feet. As her eyes barely shifted into focus, she spotted an enemy silhouetted atop a single crate right beside her. Anya swung her sword blindly right to left in a downward arc. Her vision cleared. To her astonishment, she saw the person whose legs she just slashed, a young man whose face was probably not usually this paper pale beneath long brown hair and a backward baseball cap. He was levering himself up to a half-sitting position with one hand so he could point his matte silver hand weapon at her with the other. Reversing her grip on the sword, she stabbed forward and down with frenzied speed. The blade punched through his sternum to split the heart beneath. The laser fell from lifeless fingers to the floor. Rather than try to wrench her sword free from the embrace of his ribcage, she simply released it. She grasped the fallen attacker's laser tightly in her hand. Anya spun toward the source of the laser blast, which came closer than ever to hitting her head. Anya looked up to see the figure who had shot at her from the catwalk slumped down to the perforated metal walkway.
That was for Mafalda!
Moving bent over, Anya rushed down the line of crates toward the warehouse's side door. It might as well have been 1,000 feet away if an energy gunner covered it. She had no illusions of being able to move faster than light, nor was she going to be able to read the intent of a shooter half a room away. Still bent over, she chanced a 3-second look right, seeing nothing. Lowering herself to a squat, she peered the other way. 60 feet away, Dan stood by a wall. A slight woman with long black hair crouched on the catwalk above him, holding an energy pistol in both hands with the barrel pointed toward the ceiling. The woman kept leaning cautiously over the rail, evidently reluctant to expose herself to the unseen intruder's fire. Peering intently upward as if he could see through the catwalk, Dan didn't notice Anya. He was focused on the battle at hand. Anya guessed he hoped to make his unseen antagonist flinch back long enough for him to break for the cover of the crates, or even to the door. But despite the muzzle blasts going off almost under her feet, the Promesan woman never flinched. Instead, learning exactly where her opponent was, she vaulted lithely over the rail and dropped to the concrete floor with apparent unconcern for injury. The attacker was now just feet from Dan, and with a recoilless weapon, had an easy kill lined up. What she wasn't counting on was Anya. Firing the laser was a strange experience. She felt no reaction from the weapon whatsoever. There was only a burst of green light, dazzling in the gloom, that appeared between the muzzle and a point between the woman's shoulder blades. Dan snapped his weapon down, aiming directly at the wounded woman's face.
Dan! I'll cover you! Go!
Dan sprinted to the exit. Stepping out into the spill of yellow light from the lamp above the door, he pivoted, then dropped to a knee to aim back into the warehouse from the cover of the doorframe. Anya waited a beat, then darted straight for the exit. Her cheeks went taut with anticipation of a lethal light blast between her shoulders. None came. The security response team was either all out of action or hunkered down. Exploding through the doorframe, she didn't slow down. Anya turned right to run toward the waterfront. The upstream docks were dark. Seemingly derelict warehouses lay that way. She glanced back over her shoulder. Dan was still crouched in the doorway, handgun leveled, looking at her oddly.
Come on! Follow me!
Dan rose to his feet, and they both took off again. Anya reached the corner of the next building and ducked into the enfolding shadow of a loading bay. She bent over, braced her palms on her thighs, and tried to recompose herself.
Another dry run. Lives lost. For nothing.
Not so.
Dan held up something small and dark. The lights of the docks downstream shone through the vaguely blue object and illuminated the grin on his face.
I got a thumb drive.
Fascinating.
Sir Ian Moran turned the captured energy weapon over and over in his hands. They were big hands, as Anya would expect. He sometimes played guitar or keyboard with the band, although he primarily served as vocalist. but they were more square and powerful-looking than she'd expected from a billionaire musician, scarred and calloused in ways that wouldn't be accounted for even by hours of practicing on hard steel strings. She wondered what he'd done to earn such hands. The three were gathered in his top-floor suite in the Lord Manaus. It had the same somewhat raffishly gaudy color scheme as Anya's more modest room. His Croat bodyguards were nowhere to be seen. Dan sat on a sofa, peering intently at the screen of a notebook computer opened on a coffee table in front of him. The thumb drive full of data from the warehouse computer was stuck in a USB port. The weapon Anya had taken from the young man she had killed was utterly unprepossessing. She expected an energy weapon to be futuristic-looking. Instead, it looked like a handgun, very compact and solid in its lines. Its finish looked like the brushed stainless steel revolvers she had seen. But instead of having a slide to eject an empty casing and chamber a fresh round, it seemed to be made all of one piece. And instead of a hole in the end, it had what appeared to be a glass lens, about half an inch wide.
That's it, Sirian? I bring you back a genuine ray gun and you toss it on the bed?
It's a pretty toy, I grant you, and a lethal one.
But doesn't that prove everything? The existence of some wildly technologically advanced civilization, somewhere anyway, and most likely up the Amazon where you thought it was all the time.
It hints, not proves.
But
it's not that big an advance over what exists now. Indeed, it may not be advanced at all. You'll have to trust me on this, Anya. I have certain contacts, along with which goes access to certain information not precisely widely known.
But I thought lasers still needed these huge, unwieldy energy supplies. Well, if somebody's got handheld energy weapons now, why haven't we seen them in action on the news?
What kind of advantage did they give our putative Promations? Dan brought a person armed with one down with a common handgun. You yourself won this one away from an enemy despite being unarmed.
Anya brushed a hand back through her hair to distract the older man's attention from her face. Evidently, the crates had hidden her use of the sword from her partner, or perhaps he'd been distracted by staying alive. And what he had seen that night at the Tokay, well, he must have decided his memories of that night, if he even had any, were not to be trusted.
Well, think about it, Anya. What good would ray guns do against enemies who use ambush tactics like rocket-propelled grenades?
I just have a hard time believing the government would cover something like that up. It smacks of conspiracy theory.
What do you think it means when they classify something top secret, then? What's that but a cover-up?
All right, all right.
Yes! I got it! I've broken the encryption. Now, don't give me too much credit. It's really all down to the software on this box.
Frowning slightly, Anya looked from him to Publico. The older man shrugged. His mouth twisted in an ironic smile. It struck Anya she had often seen the same expression on Dan's younger, less weathered face. She wondered if the young man had copied it from the older. She knew Dan idolized his boss. Or maybe they're just two of a kind, she thought.
In the course of my humanitarian work, my aims have at times coincided with those of certain, let's say, powerful entities. To help me do this work, these allies, temporary, I need hardly add, have seen fit to share with me certain tools not available to the public at large.
No such agency is sharing its decryption tools with you?
Now, lass, I never said NSA.
You wouldn't. I thought you got to be a billionaire by being an anti-authoritarian rebel.
Anya, my love, nobody gets to be a billionaire by being a rebel. Indeed, I didn't make most of my money through music at all. Rather, it's the outcome of ethical and judicious investing.
You've got as much loot as Sir Ian. You're a powerful entity all by yourself. But don't worry, he's still a rebel. Just a rebel who fooled the Straits into letting him get power.
Now, don't go exaggerating my influence, Dan, my lad. A billion doesn't go near as far as it once did. Now, what have you to show us today?
Well, the bad news is it's in Portuguese. I think.
And the good news is?
That this is where I earn my plane fare. Let's see. It talks about a place called Feliz Lusitania. Somebody injured there badly, could be dying. They seem to think it's important to get to him before he says something dangerous.
They're cryptic even in their encrypted communications?
Not necessarily. It's like a lot of conversations. Sometimes you get what look like gaps to an outsider, but they're really things that both parties know and so go without saying. Publico, I saw crates of medical supplies consigned to Feliz Lusitania in the warehouse.
I know that name.
What is it? Some kind of theme park for ego-tourists?
Only as envisioned by Hieronymus Bosch, my lad. It's a gold camp. Or to put it another way, a wee taste of hell on earth.
You know about it?
Aye, too well, though the world as a whole does not. There are interests far more powerful than I who prefer it that way. But there you must go, if you are willing. You must find this injured person. Aid him if you can, and find out what he or she knows.
I'm in.
I didn't come this far to back out now.
What about you, Publico?
I'll see travel arrangements made for you, of course. You'd better go by air. A riverboat moves too slowly. As for me, I'm called overseas on business that cannot wait, even for such as this. But I know whatever must be done, the two of you are right to do it. There's none better in all the world.
For hours, Anya had watched the green of the triple canopy forest, all but unbroken for mile after mile. The airfield, where the de Havilland Canada twin otter had deposited them, had seemingly been scraped from the forest in the middle of nowhere, with nothing in evidence to justify its existence but a little stream rippling along one side, past some warped plank buildings that constituted whatever facilities the place possessed. Anya and Dan had not entered them. They had been shepherded immediately from the twin-engine passenger plane to the olive-drab helicopter waiting on a single square of warped and melting asphalt 20 yards wide. Now they were somewhere over the Amazon, which sprawled out beneath them. Two muscular black men in green and tan sat like sphinxes flanking the hatchway to the cockpit, one holding a long black M16 muzzle up between his knees, the other a stainless steel and black shotgun. They had nodded in polite, if grim, acknowledgement when the two North Americans came aboard. Then they had simply refused to respond to any conversational overtures, in English or Portuguese, or Dan's halting but serviceable Spanish. Inside, the chopper stank of grease, of sweat and fear, of lubricant spilled and burned, of old gun smoke, of hot metal and mildew and dust. Anya didn't know a lot about helicopters, but she suspected from the start this one was a UH-1, the famed Huey of Vietnam War vintage. The air was so thick with smell and humidity that breathing it was like trying to inhale through a linen cloth. Easier breathing was worth risking, and Anya was perched precariously close to the open sliding door. The rainforest flowing below was almost hypnotic. If you stared into it, it could absorb you, draw you and your constituent raw materials back into nature.
Look out there!
Dan leaned to his right in his seat, pointing forward. After a moment, Anya too made something out. A wide yellow gouge, not just from the jungle's green hide, but from one side of the river itself. For a moment, Anya wondered if some giant meteor had struck recently, blasting a crater a mile or more in extent. Away off on the far end of the gouge, she made out big yellow machines chomping at the earth like vast metal insects. Closer by were oblongs that looked like cargo containers, ranked and stacked in thousands. Here and there were clumped wooden buildings and even corrugated Quonset-style structures inside fences. A high fence seemed to run around the entire perimeter of the gaping yellow wound, as if to somehow contain its infection. The stink of the place rose up like an invisible wall to smack them. The jungle always stank of tepid water and whatever had walked upon the earth before dying and rotting away. But this was different. Stronger, harsher, and far more revolting. It was the reek of raw human sewage by the liquid ton. It was mixed with a choking smell of burning diesel fuel. Anya realized it didn't just come from the earth-scraping machines eternally at work on the camp's far side, but instead from the dozens of trails of smoke that wound into the sky, each marking the site of waste being burned. The smell of filth, burned and raw, was not the most horrific thing to assail her senses. Far from it. First was the cage, a huge open box out in the sluggish river, south of the discoloration. Anya's mind at first made no sense of it, or refused to, until she could no longer deny to herself that it was filled with a score or more people, emaciated men and women dressed in rags the color of the river mud, bent over doing something in the knee-deep water. She looked back through the hatch into the cockpit, out through the stained windscreen. Just outside the perimeter fence, she saw a line of X's. Anya frowned, puzzled. As the helicopter got closer, she realized they must be steel I-beams crossed with ends buried in the yellow earth. On each of them hung a twisted, wizened shape.
I can't be seeing this.
Sure you can. It's what the world's really like. Not our white bread existence back home.
The guards took up station in the open doors. The helicopter swept over the perimeter wire. Anya could clearly see the razor tape spirals that topped it. As they passed one open area, Anya gasped at the sight of a dozen or more raggedly dressed men kicking a figure lying on its side in a fetal curl. Others struck at the victim with long rods of wood or possibly lengths of metal pipe. Some distance away to starboard, a group of six or seven men in camouflage battle dress patrolled a winding alley between shanties and containers with long guns in their hands. Most of their faces were pale beneath boonie hats. Beyond them, two groups of men in different colored camouflage shot at each other across a patch of water. The water's surface showed a rainbow sheen of oil to the morning sun. A body lay in the midst of it, a person face down, wearing a blue shirt and shorts and not moving. On the far side, a pair of men in gray and black urban-looking camo dragged a prostrate comrade by the collar to the dubious shelter of stacked plastic drums.
Boom! They're aimed at us!
Jesus Christ! They shoot at random aircraft coming in? They shoot at them?
Apparently so.
What if it's the mail? What if it's bringing medical supplies?
Evidently someone doesn't care much. It's a bad place you go, my friend. I'm sorry.
At the heart of the camp stood the largest concentration of actual buildings. This was surrounded by another high fence topped with razor tape. Just inland of it lay a second square compound, perhaps 50 yards square. Its walls were irregular and multicolored. As the chopper approached, Anya saw they were made of random sheets of painted metal. They might have been hammered out of old metal car bodies. Improvised or not, they were also topped with the inevitable razor tangles. A paved square in the barren yellow yard inside had been painted with a big yellow circle. Crouched behind Anya and craning to look between her and the M16 guard standing tensely with his finger on the trigger, Dan pointed to a gateway through the sheet metal fence. It was high and wide enough to admit a single big vehicle, maybe even a semi-trailer. Above it arched a sign of what looked like inexpertly welded wrought iron.
What's that say? That doesn't look like Portuguese.
It's Italian. It means abandon all hope, ye who enter here. Somebody's got a sense of humor.
Isn't that from...
Yeah, it's from Dante's Inferno. The sign above the gates to hell.
Oh, God.
A flabby, middle-aged man in a white suit was running toward them, bent over, clutching a white Panama hat to his head. Anya and Dan lifted their rucksacks and leapt down to the ground, jogging over in a crouch to their greeter. The plump man stopped 20 feet from the bewildered Americans. He straightened up, dusting himself off. Despite frequent rains, those went without saying hereabouts, the surface of the landing field beyond the asphalt apron managed to accrete a yellow scum of dust, which the fleeing Huey had duly kicked up into a yellow cloud. The man might have saved himself the effort. The suit, once presumably bright white, now looked like a Jackson Pollock canvas of many colored stains. Realizing this, he trotted over the rest of the way. He had bulging dark eyes and a mouth-fringing black beard. Frizzy black hair stuck out beneath his hat brim to either side of his face, which ran with sweat in sheets.
You are Dan Sado, and I'm your Creed?
We are.
I am Gustavo Gomez. Welcome to Feliz Lusitania.
Oh!
Forgive my laughter, my friends.
What was that explosion?
It is nothing. A shot for the mining operation, nothing more. Probably they clear big fallen logs. We are not under attack here. If you will please follow me, I'll see you inside the citadel.
Gomez gestured toward the gate. Beyond it, lights blazed into life against the rapidly advancing tropical twilight, up on towers inside the inner perimeter. Anya and Dan shouldered their packs and followed the guide. A fenced-in passageway, 15 yards long and maybe 20 feet wide, ran from the landing pad to the citadel. Anya realized that a pair of machine guns in the towers flanking the chain-link fence were tracking them as they approached. Her shoulders tensed and her stomach crawled as if she'd swallowed a nestful of millipedes. She found little to love about being entirely at the mercy of the men behind the weapons. Their lives depended upon the goodwill and judgment of the kind of men who'd guard a place like this. They passed through the inner gate. A pair of men in mottled green and brown camouflage battle dress waited inside. They carried Brazilian-made Imbel MD-2 assault rifles. They stared at the newcomers with a blend of contempt and disinterest before turning away.
So, was that more stump clearing?
Please, don't make such jokes, Mr. Sedon. Your employer, Sir Ian, understands the realities of what goes on in here.
He does?
Publico knows about this place. I suspect he does what he can to mitigate things.
Oh yes, of course he does. He tries to help us. He sends us the medical supplies.
You mean those shipments I saw in Manaus might have been his all along?
I don't really know. I know he knows about this place, just like he told us. But that doesn't mean he knows everything that goes on here.
The sky had gone indigo overhead, shading into black downriver. Off to the west, the last of the day lay in bands of sour lemon and ochre. Their guide led them between the neat pitched roof structures that made up most of the buildings inside the interior wire perimeter. Anya decided they were some kind of prefab housing. The place hummed with activity, but it was spiritless, more like a kind of barely controlled frenzy than enthusiasm. Gomez led them toward one of the khaki-colored prefab buildings with the green trim.
There is little to do here in the evenings, I'm afraid, although you will have satellite television in your rooms.
What exactly do you do here, Mr. Gomez?
I am an administrator. I help to run things. I have no real power here, of course. No one does, except the directors.
After they had deposited their packs in their adjacent rooms, which were surprisingly neat and comfortable, they joined Gomez in the nearly empty commissary. They were served a meal of beans, sausage, and rice that made Anya feel suddenly homesick for New Orleans. The commissary walls were bare, as were those in their rooms. The obvious reason was tight-fistedness, the desire to squeeze every possible penny of profit from this great yellow wound in the rainforest for minimum overhead. Anya suspected something more underlay it. Life was cheap in Feliz Lusitania. What went on there was so raw and elemental that any kind of ornamentation would have been absurd frivolity.
We use both open pit and sluicing methods here at Feliz Lusitania. There are rich alluvial deposits present, both on land and in the river sediments. We extract much gold.
What's going on out in the river?
You both are to enjoy our complete cooperation in your efforts, whatever they may be. That order comes from Director Oliveira himself.
We appreciate that. We'll let you know what we need when we get our bearings better.
And what about those poor bastards crucified outside the wire?
We attract unwelcome attention from outside. A very great deal of wealth flows through here.
Attention from photojournalists and the like?
No, nothing like that. Raiders, bandits.
Through all this jungle?
The river is a most broad highway.
You get that many people trying to attack such an obviously well-fortified camp?
Well, of course, order must be kept. Otherwise, anarchy will swallow us all. And in any event, they were dead when they went up. Mostly.
So, here we see jungle capitalism in all its unfettered glory.
Not at all. The majority owner of this great enterprise is the state of Amazonas, and its proceeds go for the welfare of our people. Although, to be sure, we have foreign investors. What we do here, we do for the greater good.
So the ends justify the means.
Sometimes they do, Anya.
I fear I must leave you to attend to other duties. If you have needs, ask a staff member, and they will be attended to promptly.
I'll bet.
You must understand, my North American friends. That inscription over the gate from the helipad, that does not refer to the poor devils in the cage or out in the settlement. They know their fate and how thoroughly it is sealed, and in any event, they usually do not arrive by helicopter. Those who are advised to abandon hope on entry are the lower managers and administrators, the physicians, the skilled workers, the people who actually run this place. My poor self, for instance. Because otherwise, we might imagine we had more chance to escape than those poor devils panning gold in the river. I leave you with one final bit of advice. You have the option of leaving Feliz Lusitania. It is a rare and precious gift. I should contemplate that deeply, were I you. And also, the wisdom of not asking questions whose answers cannot possibly do you any good. Good night.
The next morning, Anya and Dan ate a subdued breakfast of somewhat crusted eggs, wilted bacon, bread, and fruit from a buffet-style spread of covered hot trays that seemed left out for latecomers. There was nobody else to be seen in the commissary.
Well, I guess they know we're here. The camp administration, I mean. God knows what they think we're doing. I wonder how the hell we're supposed to proceed from here. I don't know about you, but I'm not ready to go wandering outside the Citadel by myself. Call me a coward.
Not unless I'm one, too. I know you're brave, Dan. You've got nothing to prove to me. But suicide to no purpose isn't bravery, not in my book.
You know, I think that's the first really personal thing I've heard you say.
Well, our conversations have run largely to business, small talk, or political statements, haven't they?
With me making most of the last, huh? Am I really that bad? Whoa. Either our guide just got here, or Hell's got a new work release program.
Anya turned in her chair. The woman standing just inside the entrance to the cafeteria had the hunched shoulders and swiveling head of a prey animal, and big, gold, frightened waif eyes. She was almost skeletally gaunt, and she looked all around the commissary as if expecting to see something terrible lurking in wait, coiled to spring. Then she looked back toward them.
Hi. I'm Anya Creed.
I am Dr. Ligia de Carvalho. I was told I am to be your guide.
Pleased to meet you. I'm Dan Seddon. Thanks for coming out to help us.
Listen, we can make other arrangements. You don't have to take any time out of your schedule.
Yes. Yes, I do.
Ligia lived outside the Citadel, which she pointed out with a bony finger as they scurried from cover to cover among the ramshackle buildings. She was part of the camp's small medical staff, recruited from the city of Cuiabá in the High Plains farm country of Mato Grosso State. It was an economically distressed area, and jobs weren't easy to come by. She seemed to have a knack for slipping through quiet ways, little traveled by either starveling workers or the armed patrols. The workers weren't much in evidence anyway. They labored or slept at this hour. The mines ran 24 hours a day. Still, Anya's stomach was a constant sour knot of tension from anticipating ambush at any moment. They halted behind a structure cobbled together from a random assortment of warped planks. The smell of sewage and decay were stronger than most places. Anya blinked tears from her eyes.
You work out in the colony, Ligia?
Yes.
But you said you were staff. Couldn't you live in the Citadel?
Yes.
And you choose to live in this?
Oh, yes. Much safer.
You've got to be kidding.
Out here, I enjoy a certain status. I have protectors. People understand that I help them.
What about drugs? Don't people try to steal them from you?
I have antibiotics and such things only. Nothing recreational. The pain drugs are available at a special kiosk right outside the Citadel fence. It is heavily guarded day and night. Sometimes, of course, there are those who won't accept that I have nothing to ease their pains. The shack where I live is ransacked frequently. That doesn't matter. I have nothing even for the most desperate. And when people try to force me to give them drugs or to do other things, I have only to scream. Then the people come. They take the people who are attacking me and do things to them. Terrible things. I should try to stop them, of course, or feel worse about it. But I am weak. I fear that I cannot.
Then why not live in the Citadel where it's safe?
Safe? It's far worse than out in the colony. Here I have some status. I have protectors, as I told you. Inside, they play the games of power. And no one has any friends.
But aren't they all in this together? The bosses, I mean.
What? Do you believe in honor among thieves? You are very naive, young man, though you think yourself hard.
But their class loyalties...
do not exist outside of the air-conditioned classrooms of the universities. I too once believed in such things. Then I came here and saw the truth. Whatever they call themselves, socialists, capitalists, those who have power are all mad things, struggling constantly with each other for more. Inside the Citadel, without a powerful patron, you are waiting only to be collateral damage, or a plaything for those with the sort of mind to crucify workers who try to run away.
So that's what that's all about.
But we're in the middle of the rainforest. I'd think it would be easy to disappear once someone got away from the camp.
The Indians turned them back.
They cooperate with their exploiters?
Exploiters? The directors bribe the local tribes well. And the Indians get rewards for any stragglers they bring back. Bonuses if they are still alive. As they get paid when they bring other Indians in as slaves.
My God. Oh my God.
You didn't know things like that went on, Anya?
No. I never imagined any such thing. I've seen bad things. Terrible things. I've witnessed starvation and disease and even massacre, but nothing to compare to this.
All I know is we're a terrible species. The Earth might be better off without us.
All one can hope for is the ability to distinguish between the victim and the victimizer.
I wish I had it.
Come now.
Anya tried not to consider the possibility of snipers as Legia led Anya and Dan out across a broad open space toward a container hut ahead. They turned the corner. Anya had to jump to avoid tripping over a dead body in cut-off shorts and a torn shirt pulled up around its belly. It had begun to bloat in the heat and moisture, but thankfully it lay face down. It seemed to be a male. They had not smelled it from less than 10 feet away. It was the third corpse they had encountered that day.
The patrol will probably report the body, and another team will come out to pick it up and carry it away to dump in the river.
It's a wonder that everyone here isn't dead from disease.
We have shortages of many things, but not antibiotics.
They scurried along, then slipped down an alley with containers on one side and plank hovels on the other. Even the three of them, carrying little spare body fat among them, had to turn sideways to negotiate the passage.
Legia, who would choose to come to a place like this?
They lure people from all over Latin America, and even beyond, with promises of great pay. It's all lies, of course. But once here, well, you've seen what happens to those who try to run away. And they might be the lucky ones.
What do you mean?
You saw the cage out in the river?
Oh, yes.
Once you go in the cage, you never come out alive.
What do they do in the cage?
Bound for gold. Like your gold rush, yes? They glean what is missed by the machines sluicing out in the river or scraping at the land.
What if the prisoners don't work?
Then they don't feed them. Any of them. After a while, the holdouts either come around or their fellow sufferers drown them in their sleep. Of course, they don't last long. Aside from the grinding labor and deprivation and exposure, there are the heavy metal salts.
Heavy metals?
Oh, yes. The Amazon basin is rich in heavy metals, didn't you know?
So the radioactivity gets them?
Not at all. That would take years, decades. Heavy metal poisoning works much faster. Then there's the mercury used in the open pit operation. Workers get the mercury on their skin or breathe in the vapors. Eventually, they become so deranged and feeble-minded they can't function anymore. Then they go in the cage, or are simply set loose in the colony to fend for themselves.
What happens to them in here?
They kill or are killed.
Do they fight with the guards?
Or each other. Here, life is boiled down to its essentials. Some people choose to cooperate with each other. Others live as if it's a war of all against all.
She led them onward. The colony was larger than it had initially looked, even from the air. The tension had her heart racing and the sweat soaking her more than the brutal river basin heat would account for. Crouching, Ligia led Anya and Dan forward to peer above a line of plastic drums. Anya's heart was in her throat. She saw nothing in their immediate vicinity, but one or two streets away to their right, she caught glimpses of men running and shooting.
What's going on? Mercenaries fighting.
Is it a private dispute or some kind of rivalry coming from the top down?
Who knows? Both are possible. But we must get close.
Why?
Our objective lies that way.
Can't we just go around?
We must cut as close as we can. This is a very bad part of the colony.
They began slipping forward as furtively as they could, crouched low to the ground and moving at a slow pace. Anya looked over at Dan and was unable to miss the annoyed look on his face.
Why creep around like mice? The camp inhabitants are either heading somewhere else in a hurry or lying low, and the boys doing the shooting are only interested in finding targets or trying not to be targets.
I don't want to die for an assumption, nor get run up on by reinforcements, not to mention some new team looking to get in the game.
Good point.
They advanced between two rows of the two-story container-turned dwellings into a region of ramshackle huts. In fact, this seemed the end of the scrapped containers, which, hot as they might be in the sunlight, at least were sturdy and able to keep out the rain. In front of the trio, a nasty shantytown stood, or leaned, for at least 100 yards before butting up against the 12-foot perimeter fence. The spirals of razor wire at its top glittered in the sun. Beyond stood the green wall of the rainforest, at once inviting and forbidding. Ligia led them toward an open hut and stepped through the threshold. Anya hung back, perhaps even more unwilling to violate a private dwelling than she would have been in some ritzy suburb back home. Some modicum of personal space was about the only thing resembling dignity these people had. To invade that seemed wrong. Ligia turned back towards Anya.
It's all right. No one lives here right now.
All right.
The place stank of death. Anya guessed an occupant had died and spent a few days decomposing in the jungle heat and humidity before being collected by the periodic sanitation sweeps. The hovel seemed to consist of planks and shreds of reeking cloth. Anya crept forward and peeked out the rear door. She and her companions seemed to have entered a no-man's land of the battle. To their left, Anya saw men in bluish-gray camos leaning out from cover and shooting with what appeared to be M16s and the shorter M4 carbine versions. They had the beefy, well-packed look she associated with the U.S. military and seemed to be mostly white or black. Anya guessed they were North American mercs, or security contractors, as the government liked to refer to them. She suspected that they, too, had been attracted to Feliz Lusitania by honeyed lies and trapped no less thoroughly than the wretches in that horrific cage in the river. There were ways to keep even men with guns in their place. Suddenly, up ahead, Anya spotted a small Brazilian-looking man step into view. He dropped to his knee, raised an RPG to his shoulder, and pointed it in the direction of the gunman closest to them.
Get down!
Great. If a fire starts...
Not much danger of that. It rains constantly, so the wood is always soaked.
We need to move.
Not through that door, I hope.
We'll move left. The guys to the right seem to put out a way bigger volume of fire.
I like the way you think.
To Anya's surprise, they got past the firefight without great difficulty. After moving past the men unseen, they had quickly exited the battle zone. Even though they were still surrounded by the desolation and despair that seemed to preside over the entirety of Feliz Lusitania, the area seemed relatively peaceful compared to the chaos they had just put behind them. Where earlier they had seen few people except for armed gangs of one sort or another, now they caught flashes of furtive movement inside shadowed shacks, gleams of sunlight on eyeballs peering through windows or less formal gaps in rude walls. Now and again, a man or even a woman, usually lean and scarred as an old wolf, stood glaring at them openly from a doorway.
What's with the people in this area? Don't they have jobs to go to?
Not anymore. They have found they cannot make it outside the walls, between the selva and the Indians. But they can escape to this part of the camp. The guards do not come farther than those we just came past.
Why doesn't the whole slave labor population just flood right into here, then?
Because even these slaves enjoy some measure of security. They are fed, if badly. Here, there is no support, no security, but what one can grab for oneself or one's comrades.
But you seem pretty familiar with this part of the camp, and unafraid.
I live here. I told you, I provide valuable services to the community, which everyone recognizes. These people protect me precisely because they are so desperate. And here, at least I am safe from rape by the guards.
Anya shuddered, feeling a chill run down her spine in spite of the sweltering tropical heat. The hellhole still hadn't run out of shock value. The man they sought had obviously been dying for a long time, and he'd been dying hard. Looking at him lying on a pile of rags with a skinny woman kneeling by his side and mopping his face with water from an old paint can with the label long gone, Anya guessed they had arrived just in time. A peculiarly horrific, sweetish smell came from him. It seemed concentrated on a bandage, which must have been white at one point and was now pretty thoroughly blackened, wound around his narrow middle.
Gangrene? I thought you could only get that on an arm or a leg.
Anywhere in the body where blood supply is cut off, the tissue dies and becomes gangrenous. It is far advanced in his bowels. He suffered multiple gunshot wounds. It is a wonder he has hung on for so long.
Was he shot here, in the camp?
I do not know. He simply appeared here 2 weeks ago, already wounded. He had bandaged himself after a fashion.
Appeared here? You mean in the camp?
Indeed.
But how can somebody get into a place like this, and why?
There are ways. The walls are meant to keep men in, not out. And even then, there are always ways for those willing to take risks. As to why, the good God might know. But he has clearly turned his face away from the camp. If you ask him, I promise he will not answer. No matter how loudly you scream and plead.
Anya looked to the woman at the dying man's side. She was emaciated, as well as of slight stature. Anya could not tell how old she was. She might have been a prematurely aged teenager or a middle-aged woman. The woman never glanced her way.
Hello?
If she understands Portuguese, English, or Spanish, she never shows a sign. I believe she is Indian, but even that is a guess. She appeared 2 days after he did.
What's he doing here? Other than the obvious.
You mean dying? Why do you fear to say the word? Believe me, he knows.
I'm sorry.
I know that he is waiting for it. He has said as much.
What else has he said?
Strange things. Impossible things. He is delirious. He cannot separate legend from fact.
Anya knelt on the other side of him from his faithful attendant. The stench of his decay was like a blow. The crouching woman shot her a hot-eyed look, but something in Anya's manner seemed to reassure her. She went back to her monotonous task of giving the man what tiny comfort was available. Anya wondered what he was to her and she to him. Lover, daughter, comrade in arms? She doubted she would ever know. Anya leaned in close to the man's ear.
Promesa.
I did wrong. I hope that I have paid enough, and I must have for now. For now you have come to take me home, to the Quilombo of James.
What do you remember?
I was not supposed to remember. Yet, now the memories come back to me. Sweet, so sweet.
Now is when you are supposed to remember. You must know the way.
Yes. And the outside people can never find it.
Only by proving that you know can you earn what you desire.
I will try. I see the tree.
The tree?
Yes. The tree with my trunks. On the right bank. That marks the border. The city lies many leagues beyond. Do I pass the test? I meant so much to come home. Can I?
The man's piercing blue eyes rolled back in his skull, and his strength dissolved. He melted onto the stained, sodden pile of rags.
You filthy beast! What have you done to him?
Anya spun away from the corpse, straightening to confront the woman who had spoken. She came face to face with a tall, lean, young African-looking woman with a dark green band around bushy hair, a loose olive-drab blouse worn tails out over khaki shorts and athletic shoes. Her eyes blazed with outrage. Anya realized it was the woman she had pursued from the murdered Mafalda's shop in Belém. The Promasons had come to collect their own, but they were too late. Rogue Angel is continued on the next CD.